Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
Apologies for the ads. As an independent one-woman show, ads help me recover some of my costs. If you want to skip the ads, sign up to the exclusive feed. All episodes are free from ads, and there's full-length bonus episodes as well. The link is in the show notes. You can also make a one-time donation at buymeacoffee.com/amillionOTW. And on with the show, as they say. This is A Million Other Choices, and I am your host, Kim. Today's case is my March installment of Intimate Partner Homicides in 2018, but there's a lot more to this one, and it's a story that just really boggles my mind how sometimes you can just fall through the cracks while actively trying not to do just that. This is the murder of Jennifer Semenuk. Jennifer Lynn Semenuk was born November 26, 1972, to her adoring parents, Debbie and Bill. She was the oldest of three sisters, Jessica and Jamie. The family lived in North Bay, Ontario, which is a town of about 53,000 people located about 350 kilometers north of Toronto, and about the same distance northwest of Ottawa. Her parents later divorced and her dad remarried her stepmom, Kathy. I'm not sure if Jennifer married and then divorced or not, but she had two children, Zachary and Aaliyah, with whom she was pretty much attached to the hip too. And I can't really describe to you how warmly Jennifer is remembered by family and friends. She loved to travel, go out dancing, and was into yoga, meditation, and alternative healing therapies. Her mom said of Jennifer, when she smiled, the whole world smiled. Jennifer and the kids had lived in Cambridge, but moved to North Bay in 2014 or 2015, somewhere in there, to be closer to her parents. Jennifer worked as a personal care worker for seniors and was described as kind of the neighborhood mom. She just loved being involved in not just her kids and their activities, but enjoyed the company of her kids' friends as well. She took her kids on road trips all across Canada, wanted them to see everything that Canada had to offer outside of their small community. And it was in North Bay that she met teddy bear of a man, Mark Poulin, in December of 2016. Mark was a veteran of the Canadian Armed Forces, currently working as a mechanic, and was a couple of years younger than Jennifer, born in 1975. He had been married to a woman named Shelley Foster, with whom he had three children, Pacey, Kyle, and Hannah. And he developed a really close relationship with his in-laws, Brad and Denise, as his own parents, Ronald and Rachel, lived separately, but outside of North Bay, so he didn't get to see them as much as he would have liked. And it was the same with his brother Don and sister Kim. Mark had joined the Army in 1999 as a way of supporting his young family and did three tours in Afghanistan. He was super outdoorsy, loving fishing, snowmobiling, and always loved making people laugh with his gregarious and contagious laugh. He was close with his children, who by this time were in their late teens and early 20s, and had separated from Shelley, although appear to have stayed very friendly with each other. Mark had originally joined the Army to support the family, but had found that his service grew into a passion for serving and protecting others. So finding himself newly single, with his kids getting ready to leave the house and medically retired from the Army, which was in 2013, and Jennifer was in a similar situation, with Aaliyah and Zach were both still living at home but getting ready to sort of launch into their own lives, the couple bonded rather quickly, and by the spring of 2016, Mark moved into Jennifer's house. Zach and Aaliyah got on really well with Mark, and they were both pleased to see how Mark treated Jennifer and his gentle nature with her. He opened doors for her and just really treated her like a queen. In 2017, Jennifer, who likely suffered from polycystic ovarian syndrome, had to undergo a hysterectomy, and while she was recovering on the couch, Mark would set himself down on the floor next to her. He'd fetched anything that she needed and kept her company, comforting her and just generally all around being kind, compassionate, and very helpful. Things that came fairly natural to Mark, who had a very gentle and protective nature about him anyways. Both in their early 40s, with the kids getting out of the house, the couple decided it was time to start their own path and build their lives together. So as a Christmas gift for themselves, in December of 2018, the two of them gathered up their money and paid $26,000 for a two-story house on Beacon Lane in Spring Hill, Nova Scotia, and spent their time traveling between Spring Hill and North Bay to fix up the house before they planned to move there full-time, which they were hoping to complete by the spring of 2018. Spring Hill is actually about a 16-hour drive from North Bay, so I doubt it was just on weekends that they would go back and forth. I'm not actually sure how they managed it, actually. I would love to do that kind of thing, but Jennifer had a full-time job that didn't really allow for working remotely. It's just a detail that I don't really have an answer for, but I'm kind of curious about it. Spring Hill, although perhaps most people wouldn't think so, I find it to be a very picturesque town in Nova Scotia, originally a coal mining town, which closed down shortly after the Spring Hill mining disaster in 1958, when 75 miners were killed by an underground earthquake, probably more famous for being the home of recording artist Anne Murray. Nova Scotia also has a very deep layer of permafrost, making basements uncommon, so much of the landscape is dotted with Dutch colonial-style houses. And Spring Hill is also home to the Coquitlam Mountains, which, if you stand at the very top, the views of the night sky are some of the best in the world. If it wasn't for the very heavy winter weather, I would consider Nova Scotia a retirement dream. Jennifer and Mark thought the same and weren't scared off by the winter storms or the 16-hour drive away from home. And by the 20th of March 2018, renovations were well underway and they were looking forward to move-in day. The satellite dish was up, windows replaced and ready for the blustering storms that moved through the area, and the siding had been replaced white on the main level and then a light blue-gray tint on the upper level, and matching shutters gave the house a seaside kind of cabin feel. That Tuesday morning, Jennifer's sister Jessica called her. Jennifer lived and breathed her phone, so it was odd that she didn't answer. Jessica called again a bit later, and when she again didn't answer, a tingling sensation told her something wasn't right. Jessica called her mom, Deborah, and Debbie, her mom, and Bill, and Jessica all started to call the RCMP office in Spring Hill, and all three of them kept getting only through to Central Dispatch. Meanwhile, over in Spring Hill, the house had been quiet that day. Mark's truck was parked out front and the couple were starting to kind of be known around town as the new people from Ontario. Around 4 p.m., though, a neighbor looked out their window to see that the house appeared to be on fire. Spring Hill Fire Chief Stanley Hunter arrived with his crew and they were able to get the blaze under control relatively quickly. Most of the damage was on the interior of the house and the fire was suspicious appearing to have been started in the basement. There had not been any fire alarm or detector working because the house was still under some construction, leading the fire department to not being alerted until it could be seen from the exterior by the neighbor. The other cause of the fire not being detected and help called was the occupants of the house were deceased, a 45-year-old woman and 42-year-old man believed to be that of Jennifer and Mark. As the fire was both suspicious in nature and had two fatalities, the Major Crimes Unit took over the investigation. And RCMP Constable Dale Hutchinson wasn't able to tell the community, who were shocked obviously by such an event, much information, stating only that given that the fire at this stage is deemed suspicious, we are not able right now to identify the cause of the fire, and that they were going to have a debriefing 2 days later at the fire department to help some of the first responders. Quote, we've got four of our individuals right now who are having a hard time dealing with it. They're fairly new. North Bay Constable Mitch Thomas knocked on Zachary's door to give him the news that they suspected that Jennifer was the victim of the fire. And Debbie was there as well, and they were all still frantically trying to get a hold of Jennifer, and she asked if they had any details for them, and he did not, other than them based on her tattoos, they were pretty sure that it was Jennifer. Before the autopsy was complete, which would be the following day when she would officially be identified, the family knew that Jennifer had been the victim of a murder-suicide. And Jennifer had been the one that had been murdered. And their feeling was confirmed as Jennifer's cause of death had not been the fire, but blunt force trauma. Mark's cause of death has never been released, but the family's pretty sure it was the result of a suicide. But why were they so sure, you ask? Well, the couple didn't have any history of domestic incidents. They were getting along great, and everything in every way just would never have pointed to such an end for either one of them. Not Mark. Mark was a good guy. He opened doors for her. The family loved him. His family loved him. He had lots of friends. He had even been the subject of an award for his work in Afghanistan. So how could this have happened? Mark had been known for his charismatic smile and athleticism and hockey and football, and for his willingness to step up and help others, like helping neighbors with their groceries and walking old ladies across the street. He smiled often, and he never displayed an ounce of aggression. But Jessica said to the Chronicle, "This is a case of PTSD. My sister's fiancé, Mark, who is the other deceased, suffered very, very hard from PTSD, and I believe it was an act of rage, and he did kill her. It's a homicide. We don't know how he killed himself, but we believe he set a fire in the basement of the house first and then killed himself." But she and the rest of the family couldn't put all of the blame on Mark himself for the tragedy, saying, "We just can't. There's no blame or anything like that. It will be rocky waters, but we all have a loss. It just, I'm assuming, got the best of him. That's the only explanation we have." Now, because this is a murder-suicide, there's not going to be a lot of details. So not even the family really knows what happened on March 20th, 2018, in the hours before 4 p.m. when the fire broke out. And the matter will, of course, never go to court. With both Mark and Jennifer now deceased, there's no one to ask. Jennifer's family assumes that something set Mark off, either in a rage or a major anxiety attack. It really could have been anything, even just dropping a floorboard that might have sparked a reaction to him. He likely reacted by striking her in the head with something, quickly realized what he had done, and then decided it was time to peace out of this world. Not to avoid the consequences of his actions so much, but to just stop all of it. When Mark had joined the Canadian Forces in 1999, he had been a master corporal and served as an infantryman, a field engineer, and a combat engineer before his time when he was deployed overseas. He was deployed out of the regiment in Petawawa, Ontario, and the first time he was sent to Kabul and then twice to Kandahar. He had returned from his final tour in Kandahar in 2010 and by then had come back a different person, often withdrawn and definitely fighting demons of survivor's guilt and trauma. I mean, there's really no way to say it other than he was different. And in fact, in August, he had attempted suicide by overdosing on his PTSD medications and spent a number of days hospitalized as a result of that. In a journal, he had written afterwards that he had really wanted to get his life back on track and get back to being able to properly take care of his family. In his writings, he said that he would recover from this, but that the Veterans Affairs program had work to do, saying, "I'm just happy that I'm not going to be another soldier that falls through the cracks of the fucking support system they have for vets." And after his suicide attempt, he was prescribed medical cannabis, but he didn't really like taking it, and he felt that it didn't really help with his specific symptoms, which were something that he didn't really talk about that much. Mark had been medically released from duty in 2013, the details of which have not been released, of course, but a diagnosis of PTSD was on record for him. After his release, he was put through a 4-week course paid for by the military, specifically for soldiers returning from active duty or leaving the military with PTSD. And Mark joined a support group and sometimes saw a social worker. One of his family members said he came back in person, but his spirit was different. You could sense it in him. I mean, he still loved and cared, but you could tell he was carrying something, and it was due to a couple of incidents that occurred on one of those tours. And Mark often posted on Facebook about his struggles with PTSD and how he was kind of being let down by the system that wasn't really helping him. His wife at the time, Shelley, saw that Mark was different after he had returned and described him as plagued by illness and its demons. He couldn't seem to escape the memories and images in his mind of trying to get to a woman who had been blown apart by an explosion, and the guilt ate away at him and he wasn't able to escape those images. In another tour, he had watched as one of his really close friends stepped on an explosive device and died, and the incident also injured him but left him with a traumatic brain injury. But despite keeping his feelings close to his chest, he openly sought treatment, and Alaya and Zach remember him calling around, making numerous phone calls every week trying to get help from Veterans Affairs and expressing his frustrations over their lack of responsiveness. Shelley was only able to really help so much, so the marriage started to fall apart, leading to their separation 3 years later. Jennifer didn't really talk about Mark's issues with anyone in the family. Her sister Jessica kind of remembers, "The only thing that she told me 2 weeks ago was that they were happy best friends and that they have a blast together. Now, I will tell you that the second time I met him, which was 2 weeks ago, he seemed a little off to me. But at that time, I didn't know anything about the relationship, so I can't say I should have helped because I didn't know. He just seemed off." Now, Jason Hill was a sort of like a childhood friend of Mark's. He told the National Post, who, of course, kind of ran with the story, that he had been aware that Mark was experiencing bouts of rage that wasn't like him and suggested that the cause had been some anti-malaria drugs that he was given before going to Afghanistan back in 2003, being quoted as saying, "I know he mentioned drugs and shots before going that he believed affected him." But Shane McDonald, who's Mark's cousin, was adamant that PTSD had been the critical factor in their death, stating PTSD is a mental illness. Whatever comes out on top of that, that is the root. Now, Shane obviously was furious with Jason for making these statements, claiming that, yes, they had been friends as kids, but had little contact with him after high school, just occasionally running into each other at their kids' events. And Jason actually later retracted his comments, telling the National Post, "Mark's family and myself do not want any statements from me about Mark after 1998. I was an outside observer and witnessed very few situations. I am not qualified to diagnose, nor do I recall specific details." So he had clearly been put in his place. His son Kyle said at his memorial, "I'm trying so hard to be strong for everyone, but I can't stop thinking about how much we all love you and miss you. Your demons were so loud that you couldn't hear how much everyone was trying to help you and be there for you. I'm so sorry that you let them take over." In Canada, there are about 5,200 veterans who served in Afghanistan that are currently receiving disability benefits for PTSD. But throwing money at veterans isn't really what's needed. Between 2017 and March of 2018, just in Nova Scotia alone, there were 4 murders of family members by veterans. PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, is estimated to affect about 10% of war zone veterans in Canada. What is now referred to as PTSD is, I mean, it's been around for as long back as ancient Greece. World War I, it was known as being shell-shocked, and in World War II, war neurosis, and then in Vietnam, combat fatigue. The specific trauma that triggers PTSD is different for every person, and trauma certainly doesn't discriminate and can affect a person of any age, gender, or life station. But it's mainly classified by the symptoms like intrusive avoidance and arousal symptoms. Intrusive symptoms are things like distressing memories or images of an incident, nightmares of the event, flashbacks, becoming upset when reminded of the incident, in which you can have physical symptoms such as sweating, increased heart rate, or muscle tension when reminded of that event. Avoidance would be trying to avoid any reminders of the trauma, such as thoughts, feelings, conversations, activities, places, people. There's gaps in your memory. You might forget parts of the experiences. Losing interest in your normal activities, feeling cut off, detached from your loved ones, feeling flat or numb, and difficulty imagining having a future. According to the Government of Canada, specifically its Veterans Division, it is important to understand that PTSD often is linked to an overwhelming experience or series of events that is hard to accept or understand. It doesn't fit with our view of the world or ourselves, the way we think things are or should be. Human beings have a natural tendency to try and make sense of things that happen around them. And when people experience a trauma, The event keeps coming back into their mind in an attempt to make sense of what happened. This is a natural way of trying to deal with or come to terms with difficult experiences and seems to work well for many stressful life events. However, due to the high level of distress associated with memories of more severe trauma, the thoughts and feelings tend to be pushed away to protect the person from this distress. The result is that while the memory may go away for a period of time, the need for it to be dealt with has not been addressed and it keeps coming back. The movement backward and forward from intrusive thoughts and feelings about the trauma to avoidance and numbing can continue almost indefinitely unless the cycle is addressed in some way. Now, if those symptoms don't sound awful enough that we just talked about, the after effects of them sound even worse. Things like depression, loss of sexual interest and function, thoughts of suicide, heart palpitations and shaking, muscle tensions and feelings of terror. 50% of people with PTSD go on to have issues with drugs and alcohol. Then there is how family and friends can be affected by it. Traumatized people can be very consumed or overwhelmed by their feelings. They may become preoccupied with survival in situations that they perceive as threatening, and this may lead others to believe that individuals with PTSD are selfish and thinking only of themselves. Partners, family members, and friends, they tend to feel pushed away and rejected, and this in turn can leave the sufferer feeling isolated and unloved. The traumatized person can become controlling and irritable to family members, feeling that they're protecting them from their perceived dangers. And all of that sounds completely terrible and something that you would never want to experience and sounds almost impossible to overcome. Well, the good news is the government offers a variety of tips and tricks to help you out, including eat healthy meals. Get regular aerobic exercise like walking, jogging, swimming, or cycling. You might want to take the opportunity to go for regular walks with your partner. Oh, and this is a really good one for intrusive thoughts. To help stop the constant stream of worrying and anger-producing thoughts, set aside a specific time each day for thinking. Look after your partner if you have one. Try to clarify your feelings and assumptions about him or her and check out whether those feelings and assumptions are accurate. You can't get healthy men to do that one. Now, I don't want to be completely glib about this. There are specific treatments of medications and therapy that do help with PTSD, and Mark was seeking them all out. But have you ever tried to fill out a government form? Well, Veterans Canada doesn't make it easy either. First, you have to get a diagnosis, then you have to apply for your Veterans Affairs card and account and benefits. And then you aren't really treated any different than anyone else with a disability. The supports are painfully inadequate. And if you are unable to hold down a job due to your disability, well, good luck putting your roof over your head or feeding yourself. There was so much more that should have been done for Mark and would have saved Jennifer. And the president of the Veterans Emergency Transition Services, Jim Lowther, agrees with that, saying that Canada needs a national treatment facility just for veterans to help them transition from to civilian life. But even he had the nerve to say that it might not have been PTSD that drove Mark's actions, and it wasn't possible now to know if maybe it could have been a brain tumor or some other mental illness at work. After all, he said, normally people with PTSD just kill themselves. He didn't say that in those words, but it was inferred. Like, this story would have been a million times less sad had he only taken himself out. And normally I would agree in the case of murder suicides, but I think Mark's family and Jennifer's would have been pretty gosh darn sad if he'd have done that. After all, he was seeking treatment to have a better quality of life. But he does concede that the military is letting people go before things are in place. And the chief of defense staff said that he wouldn't release anyone from the military that wasn't ready. But unfortunately, it's still happening. A spokesperson for Veterans Affairs Canada released a statement that the department has a well-established national network of around 4,000 mental health professionals who deliver services to veterans, operational stress injury clinics across the country, as well as a 24-hour toll-free helpline and short-term face-to-face mental health counseling and referral services. And last year, the military announced a suicide prevention strategy that seeks to reduce the risks of suicides across the entire military and veterans community. And all of them are available in larger Canadian cities. There's nothing in the smaller communities like North Bay or Spring Hill. Both Mark and Jennifer's families have said that if you feel the need to help, donations to Wounded Warriors would be very much appreciated. It's something that Jennifer and her helping and kind nature would have 100% been behind. And you can find more information about them at woundedwarriors.ca or calling 1-888-706-4808 or emailing info@woundedwarriors.ca. Now, normally I tell you the story of a woman murdered by her brute asshat of a husband and then rant about what needs to be done about intimate partner homicides. But I, like Jennifer's family, I don't find myself angry at Mark for his actions, just sad about the whole thing. Sad and disappointed for both of them and both their families. What a truly sad, sad story. And yet another shameful slight on our country and our lack of action to prevent these types of tragedies. And with that, I'm going to be back again next week with another sad and preventable tragedy. As always, thank you so much for listening.
The world of 911 emergency dispatching is brutally diverse. One minute you can be talking with someone about parking violations.
What's the process we are to take to have people towed? Because it's actually delaying the mail.
And then all hell can break loose. Then the rest of the day is crazy. We could have murders.
Hill County 911, what's your emergency?
I just killed my children.
Home invasions.
He's in my house.
I shot him.
You shot him?
He was coming up towards me and I shot him.
Natural disasters.
Tornado came through and got us. I'm buried under a bomb to all my life.
Even bombings. My show, Music City 901, will put you in the dispatcher's chair, put you ear to ear with the callers and responders, and keep you on edge from start to finish. I hope to both educate and entertain, as I'm a 911 dispatcher with over 20 years' experience. And just like dispatching, every episode is different from the last. Music City 901. Real 911 calls, real 911 dispatchers. Available to listen to on any podcast app.